Yeah, we're okay to record. Right, good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Oh. Right, we're going to be looking at a new series called Talking Point. And the idea is to look at various subjects that are going around, things that you might be talking about in supermarkets, at work or whatever, and trying to put a Christian perspective on them. I've got a few ideas. If you want other things, you suggest them. There's going to be a page on the website under the blog. One of the tabs on that will be Talking Point. The sermon outlines will be there. If you want to sort of make a comment, ask a question, make a suggestion on the website, fine. Go ahead. No problem at all. Okay, Gillian, next one, please. Tonight, what we're going to be looking at is euthanasia. Sometimes called assisted suicide, doctor-assisted suicide, doctor-assisted dying, mercy killing. It's got a whole wide range of titles, but the actual title is euthanasia. The word euthanasia comes from the Greek euthanos, which means a good death. Okay? For a definition of euthanasia, it means to take a deliberate action with the express intention of ending a life to relieve persistent, unstoppable suffering. Okay? So you're ending somebody's life to prevent suffering. Some interpret euthanasia as a practice of ending a life in a painless manner. Some disagree with that, but that's the sort of rough definition that a majority of people might accept, put it that way. There are essentially two kinds of euthanasia. There's voluntary euthanasia and there's involuntary euthanasia. Voluntary euthanasia is obviously conducted with the consent of the person that you're going to put to death or you're going to kill. And since 2009, that's been legal in Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and a couple of states in the US, as far as I'm aware, Oregon and Washington. Involuntary euthanasia, you might think, oh, well, that doesn't happen, but we'll give you the definition of that, and we'll see a little bit later. That's euthanasia conducted without consent. In other words, somebody puts somebody else to death without that person saying, that's what I want. The decision to put somebody to death is made by a third party. So it's not me saying, I've had enough, please kill me. It's you saying, we've had enough of him, we're going to kill him. I'm glad nobody nodded at that point, you know. But there we go. There are two ways of conducting euthanasia. There's what's called passive euthanasia. That's where life-sustaining treatments, and I stress treatments, are withdrawn. So that, say, for example, you got somebody on a respirator, and that respirator is helping them to breathe, you turn off that respirator. Without that respirator, they then die. That is what would be classed as passive euthanasia. The treatment was actually keeping them alive. Yeah? Active euthanasia is where you take a deliberate action, normally with some sort of drug, although it can be a physical means as well. I mean, there are cases of simply people putting a pillow over somebody else's face and smothering them. Whether it's drugs or whether it's a pillow, that is active euthanasia. So is it actually in the news? Could you pop the next slide on, please, Gillian? July 16th this year, the headlines were that Europe rejects the right to die in a legal battle. And what that was where an assisted suicide campaigner had lost a legal battle against the UK and decided to take it to the European courts. A person called Jane Nicholson brought the case on behalf of her husband, Tony, who was in what was known as locked-in syndrome. He had gone to the High Court in the UK. His case had been rejected. As it happened, he died a couple of days later. But she actually took the case to Strasbourg, but the European Court of Human Rights unanimously rejected the claim that he should be allowed to end your life early. Reacting to the judgment, a guy called Peter Saunders, who's the General Secretary of the Christian Medical Fellowship, welcomed the decision. He said this: "Any changes in the law to allow assisted suicide in any circumstances at all would inevitably place pressure on elderly disabled people to end their lives for fear of being a burden on others or the state." Could you pop the next slide on, please, Gillian? This was a headline on Monday, July the 20th, so it's, you know, really recent, this sort of thing that's going around. This was a court in the UK that rejected an assisted suicide battle. And again, it says that this was a claim by a man with, again, locked-in syndrome, that the doctor should be allowed to help him to die. A 50-year-old, identified only as AMR Martin, argued that general medical council guidance unreasonably stopped help being given to those who wanted to die. He was almost totally paralysed by a stroke, he was unable to speak, and wants to have the option of ending his life. The problem that he had was that to go to different countries to have euthanasia performed upon him, he would have to take his medical records, and his doctor refused to do that. Simply because in the law, if you encourage or assist the person to die, you are liable. So the headlines are there. These are this last week when they were about. It's something that perhaps people have been talking about where you are. You might have heard people saying, oh, well, you know, if anything happens to me, just put me out in the misery kind of thing. I mentioned at the start that there are countries now where that is actually legal. One of those countries is Belgium. Could you pop the next slide on, please, Gillian? Would you like to read that? Would anybody like to read that?
Belgian woman treated by physician assisted suicide.
Yeah, treated. All right, it's no longer actually killing. We're now calling this a treatment. A healthy 24-year-old woman, as far as I'm aware, this has now happened, but at the time when it was written, June the 23rd, it hadn't. She planned to undergo physician-assisted suicide this summer for psychological reasons. The woman, known only as Laura, has reportedly had suicidal thoughts since childhood. She's quoted as saying, "That's not for me." Belgian law only requires a doctor's consent to be euthanized even when otherwise healthy. In Laura's case, the psychiatric determined that her depression was treatable by death. Can you see how things have already progressed in a few years? Now we're calling this a treatment. We're calling killing people a treatment. Apparently that was approved, and she was due to die sometime this summer through lethal injection. Could you pop the slide on for the third? That one's okay. That's one, yeah. This was last year. This was stunning. Belgium's parliament has now voted through child euthanasia. If you follow things through to the logical conclusion, they're only taking things to the logical conclusion. Why should it stop at 18? Why? You know, what logical reason? There is none. If adults can decide to be put to death, then why not children? It says that a child would be have to be terminally ill or unbearing bearing physical suffering and make repeated requests to die before it's considered. Parents, doctors and psychiatrists would have to agree to make the decision. A guy called Joseph Lennard, who is the head of the Catholic Church in Belgium, said this: "The law says adolescents cannot make important decisions on economic or emotional issues, but suddenly they're able to decide that someone should make them die. And there is a continual push." Could you pop the next one on for us, please? Thanks, Gillian. Oh no, I think it was the one before that. Okay, don't worry if there isn't one. This one was from France. This was actually in 2013. says that President Hollande had stated that he will push for a greater national debate on the right to assisted suicide and bring a bill to Parliament that would allow doctors to directly assist ending a terminal patient's life. This goes against the recommendation of the French National Ethics Committee, where a majority voted against extending euthanasia rights, okay? The medical committee said, no, we don't want to go there, but President Hollande says, that's where we're going. One of the major problems they highlighted was this. There was potential for abuse if it was permitted for terminally ill patients. They noted the use of assisted suicide has gradually expanded in countries where it is legal, like the Netherlands, Belgium, Switzerland, Luxembourg, and has resulted in abuses. So often people talk about slippery slopes. This has only been around since 2009, but surely what we've already seen has shown us we're on a very slippery slope. There's a guy called Jack Kovacin, a doctor in America, and he gives us a glimpse into the future of where this could go. He became famous because he came up with a suicide machine, and he had his first client for that in 1990. Basically, he put a drip into them that contained just salt, and then at a point they pressed the button, and into the saline drip there was a lethal drug introduced, so that they were effectively saying, yeah, I'm ready to go now. He was interviewed by Cornerstone magazine, and they had an interview with him, and it revealed something of his thinking. This is what he said. I believe that there are people who are healthy and mentally competent enough to decide on suicide. People who are not depressed. Everyone has a right to suicide because a person has a right to determine what will or will not be done to the body. In every major city, he would like to see clinics that he would call orbitoriums set up for those who wanted to commit suicide. You have to draw up a strict legal code of ethics, he said, to regulate these clinics. Both society and doctors, but doctors mainly, would work to establish the code of ethics or rules to govern it. The origin of the rules to govern, however, must come from the situation as it exists, and the code must fit the situation, and the rules to govern must change as the situation changes. That's the way to keep control. Not something inflexible that applies for 2,000 years, I wonder what he's hinting at here, but an ethical code that will change a decade or a few years later. Rules to govern should never be set in stone. They can't be. They must change constantly. That's why we have problems today, because most of the ethics are dictated by inflexible religious doctrines saying that human life is divine and it cannot be ended. Who said that? I don't feel holy. He said it's just between the patient and the doctor. Nothing else counts. The reporter said to him, what guarantees that the doctor will make the correct decision? The correct ethical choices. Okay, could you pop the next slide up, please, Gillian? This was his response to that. Who can control it? He said, I can keep control while I'm alive. But after I die, you'll get corruptible doctors running them. But that doesn't scare me. That should scare society. That's society's problem. What? Is that washing your hands of a situation or what? I'll look after it while I'm around, but after that, I couldn't care less. But his views on euthanasia don't stop at planned death. What I say is, follow things to the logical conclusion. He believes that there are extraordinary opportunities for what he calls terminal experimentation. The ability to experiment on those who are going to die. Because let's face it, what's the end result? They're going to die. So if the experiment goes wrong, does it matter? He actually believes that the Nazi medics did the right thing in the wrong way. I'll say that again. He believes that the Nazi Nazi medics who were experimenting on Jews and others in the war were doing the right thing in the wrong way, more often than not because they weren't using anaesthetics. He thinks that there ought to be a code of conduct for any professional or lay individual so that they could experiment on human beings who were facing undeniable, imminent and inevitable death. The experiments could be of any kind or complexity, so long as no distress was felt by the subject. But actually, we're not going to interview the subjects afterwards, so how are we going to find that out? He says that the subjects could include all brain dead, the comatose, the mentally incompetent, or otherwise completely uncommunicative individuals, neonates, infants, children less than, and there's a blank, years old. So where should we draw the line on children? If the subject's body is alive at the end of the experiment, death may be induced by one of the following: removal of organs for transplantation, a lethal dose of a new or untested drug, or a lethal intravenous dose of a known drug. So you could even sort of have a second experiment running with the first, in that you could introduce a new drug just to see how effective it was at killing them. He also said that he would like to move from euthanasia into an area called euthanasia, or best death. He's spoken of the need for a commercial market in euthanasia. Because let's face it, if somebody is going to die, you've got a whole range of organs to go at, haven't you? You think that's crazy? You may have seen in the news what's happening in America with an organization called Planned Parenthood, who are working in the field where they are regulating pregnancies, often by abortion. And what they're doing is they are, and I have to be careful here, but they are getting organs from the aborted fetuses and passing them on. Okay? So what this guy was talking about, commercial markets, is in one sense already there. So what about the arguments for euthanasia? The first one is easing people's pain. People are suffering, they're in great pain, they're dying anyway, so to end their life sooner eliminates the problem of pain. Does that sound reasonable? You can see where they're coming from, perhaps. The problem is that it's not only the terminally ill who suffer with pain. Chronic pain, enduring pain, pain that's going to go on, it's not just those who are dying. You have people with muscular dystrophy, multiple sclerosis and such like. They also talk of dignified death, wanting to exercise control. But it's not just the terminally ill, there are other people who have a right, if there is a right, to end their own lives when they see fit. It's their own body, surely they should dispose of it how and when they want. Could you pop the next slide on for me, please, Gillian? This is a guy called Ryan Anderson. This is what he said. Safeguards seeking to minimize the risk of killing people against their will have proved to be inadequate and are often being watered down or eliminated. You only have to see what's been happening in Belgium, how things have expanded from the original idea and where they are going to at the moment. Some of the touchstone words are choice, control, autonomy, and dignity. The idea being that if you have a choice, you know, you go to your supermarket and you can pick whatever kind of shreddies you want, surely you can have choice over your own life and other matters. Have control over your own life. And it's up to me, you know, what happens to me doesn't influence you. And when I have a choice, when I'm in control of myself, then I have my dignity. The problem is there are people who are reliant on other people to make choices. They don't have control of their own lives. So does that mean that they don't have dignity? If somebody is disabled mentally or physically, if somebody is unable to look after themselves, such as young children, does that mean to say they no longer have dignity? Some of the biggest opponents of physician-assisted suicide are those representing the disabled. They realise that people with disabilities are told that life with a disability, if you need a lot of care, is not dignified and is not worth living. Could you pop the next slide up for me, please, Gillian? Between 1939 and 1941, more than 70,000 intellectually and physically disabled people were exterminated by the Nazis. They weren't deemed dignified in their living. They weren't capable of living dignified, worthwhile lives. So what do you do with them? If they're worthless, you get rid of them. It shows where things can go. You look at people in situations like that and you say, they've got no quality of life. I'd just like to show you a short video. It's taken from YouTube, so the quality is not 100%. But it's a guy called Nick. You might have already seen him. Yeah. You might look at him and wonder. But let's just have a look.
I wasn't ready! I have no one in my life, but I'm very thankful that I have a little chicken drumstick here. People freak out when they see me for the first time. It's so cool, I was at a water slide all by myself. Everyone always said the bottom of the slide was waiting for other people to come down. The right company freaking out. They're like, yeah, I like it. And I was so tempted to look at myself and go, what happened? You know? There were times where I sort of looked at my life and thinking, well, I can't do this and I can't do that. And you keep on concentrating on the things that you wish you had or the things that you wish you didn't have. And you sort of forget what you do have. And there's no point, I believe, in my life where I wish I had arms, legs, I wish I had arms, legs, I wish I had arms, legs, I wish I had one heart. But what I've seen in life are just a couple of key principles. And the first thing that I've seen is to be thankful. It's hard to be thankful, man. I tell you, when I was 8 years old, I sort of summed up my life and thought, I'm never going to get married. I'm not going to have a job. I'm not going to have a life of purpose. What kind of a husband am I going to be if I can't even hold my wife's hand? It's a lie to think that you're not good enough. It's a lie to think that you're not worth anything. Crazy, I can't do my hand. I love life. You know, so many people come and say, how come you smile so much? And I'm like, well, it's a long story. But it's very simple at the same time. You see, it's very hard to smile sometimes in life. There are things that happen that you don't know and you don't understand and you don't know if you're going to get through it. You know, you go through your storms in life and you don't know how long the storm's going to be. And today I'm going to share with you some principles that I've learned in my life that you can use in yours. Being patient with you, I tell you, it's the hardest thing. But I realize I may not have hands to hold my wife's hand. But when the time comes, I'll be able to hold her heart. I don't need hands to hold her heart.
You know, it is scary to know how many girls have eating disorders. It is scary to know how many people are just angry at life because of their situation at home and anger at others. It's scary to know how many people are actually.
When Nick was born, How many people would look at him and think, his life is not worth living?
Yeah.
We might as well put him out of his misery. So what's the biblical view? In Deuteronomy 32:39, we see this. See now that I myself and he, says God, there is no God beside me. I put to death and I bring to life. I have wounded and I will heal, and no one will deliver out of my hand. Job 1:21. Job says, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I will depart. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. The Lord is sovereign over life and death. Man takes that sort of responsibility at his peril. We try to enact laws, but the laws don't work. Because what we're working with is human nature, and that inevitably goes downwards. Psalm 139:16 says, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Ecclesiastes 3:2 says this, there is a time to be born and a time to die. God has ordained our days and is in control of our lives. Whether you're as you are now, or whether you're like Nick, God has our days written in his book. What's the purpose of life? As you're talking to different people, you will get different ideas. But certainly one of the things is to be happy. Really, our aim in life is to glorify God. Obviously, as you speak to non-Christians, they won't accept that. But surely there's more to life than just being happy. Gillian, could you pop the next slide on for me, please? We talked about being an individual. And while I'm certainly an individual with rights, I'm equally a member of my community. And I have duties and responsibilities to that community. I must take my individual moral decisions in the light of how they will affect those around me. It isn't just about me. One of the things that we see throughout the Word of God is a fact of community. We are not just islands floating about to suit ourselves. We interact with each other. We have responsibilities. The Bible specifically condemns murder. Exodus 20:13. You shall not murder. Active euthanasia, like murder, has premeditated intent. We can condemn it as immoral and even criminal. Self-administered euthanasia, suicide, is self-murder. There's no such thing as a right to die. Euthanasia denies God the opportunity to work in a shattered life and to bring glory to himself. A woman named Joni Erickson Tada was a very active, outgoing young woman. She had a diving accident and she was transformed instantly into a quadriplegic. She lost use of her arms and her legs. In the hospital, she said, why can't they just let me die? A friend said to her, the past is dead, Joni, but you're alive. Her retort to that is, am I? You call this living? That was in the very raw moment when she realized that life as she knew it had changed like that. And yet, the story of Joni is absolutely amazing how God worked through her. Someone who was into sort of pursuits and such like became an artist who painted and has now had a worldwide ministry encouraging people and showing them that there's an awful lot more. How many would look at her moments after her accident and say, we'll put her out of her ministry. We'll stop that suffering. We'll sort it out for her. Death is unnatural, yet inevitable. It's a consequence of the fall. But it's also, according to 1 Corinthians 15:26-56, the last enemy to be destroyed. According to Ecclesiastes 12:7, James 2:26, death occurs when the spirit leaves the body. So a comatose patient may not be conscious, but very much alive. And treatment should be continued unless crucial vital signs of brain activity have ceased. And comatose patients do recover. the story of a 23-year-old woman called Judy who was in a coma for 3 months. A professor made his daily rounds of the hospital, went through with his medical students, you know, following behind him. He passed by a bed, and he would say, "Judy is in a coma, she'll never wake up." According to a doctor, when she came out of the coma, she told him, "I always remembered that professor coming past my bed and saying she will never wake up." She was very much aware of what was going on around her. MRI scans show that people in comas respond to family members' voices. They respond to songs they know. They can see and trace it. And we might not be able to do anything from the outward that shows that this person is alive, but they're still there. Conversely, we have to reject the notion that absolutely everything must be done to preserve life at any cost. We have a sure home. There are times when we will say, okay, no more treatment. You might have heard of a guy called David Watson. He was the minister just out at York. He had cancer. And for a while, he worked with the doctors to try and stop it, but it was obvious that it was just going on, and there was only one end in sight. And in the end, he said, okay, this treatment is actually going nowhere. All you're doing is making it worse for me. Let's just stop. That is the passive form of euthanasia, where you say, you're not killing them, you're allowing the disease, the illness or whatever to take its natural course. Bring it closer to home. Mark's mum, Mark Bergin's mum, Letty, has been diagnosed as having terminal lung cancer and liver cancer. And she said, okay, I don't want any treatment. We'll leave it at that. There's no point. All you're going to do is maybe prolong my life for a little bit longer. I'll go through chemotherapy, radiotherapy or whatever. Let's just call it quits at this point. We have a sure home. We have a destiny. And that is certain and secure. A preacher named Rob Parsons was in his church one day. And he said, hands up everybody who wants to go to heaven. So let's do the same. Hands up everyone who wants to go to heaven. Yeah? He then put the second question. Keep your hand up if you want to go now.
Not yet.
Exactly. And the response was that a lot of people pull their hands down. Well, if we think about it, and if it's God saying now's the time, okay, because it's far better. So what conclusions can we draw? A guy called Pascal Emmanuel Gobi said this. The most frustrating thing about any discussion of euthanasia is the fact almost everyone forgets. It's a stubborn fact, which is the only thing that truly matters in this issue. And it's this. As most people who have worked in palliative care, those who are working with end-of-life scenarios to try and ease it and make it easier, they will tell you that in almost every single time a terminal ill patient professes that they want to die, it is a cry for help. And almost every single time when the assertion that they want to die is met with increased care and compassion, the desire goes away. Could you pop the next slide on for me, please, Julian? Polls show 50 to 60% in favour of euthanasia, but that's a poll of healthy people. In actual sufferers, it's less than 2%. And when people are given proper pain relief, it's less than 1% continue to say, I want to die. Does that stagger you? Does that stun you? Does it surprise you? When people are taken care of properly, the desire to die goes away. The desire to live is so strong. Sometimes the reason for wanting to die is rooted in physical pain, but that is something that we're getting better at alleviating. Sometimes the problem is psychological. Feeling diminished or stripped of autonomy, it can be crushing. But as anyone with a smattering of human psychology knows, That's a feeling that must be confronted with love so that it leads to acceptance. Sometimes, terribly and perniciously, the reason has to do with the family and the sincere sense that it is one's duty not to be a burden on loved ones, a feeling which loved ones, if they're loved and loved back, will respond with more love. This is what makes any abstract debate about values a very slippery slope. Ultimately, the temptation to talk about right to die must be resisted at all costs. In the beds of sorrows, the souls of the dying cry out to us with one voice, and they demand only one thing, love. And that is the only thing that we ought to give them. A doctor called Megan Best, who is a practitioner in palliative care in Australia, said that she was going around with her lead doctor, and at one point she came across a young man, and he said, "Put me out of my misery, you wouldn't let a dog suffer like this." The lead doctor's response was, "You're not a dog, you're a man. You're going to die like a man." And what he meant by that was they helped him, they relieved his pain, and his request to die ceased. He lived for a little while longer after that, but he wanted to continue living. Life is precious. It's not a question of whether life is worthwhile, rather it's a question of whether the treatment is worthwhile. Is it productive? Active euthanasia weakens respect for human life. Withdrawing treatment can sometimes reach a point where it's pointless, where it's burdensome upon the actual patient. An auntie of mine had cancer. It was actually in a skull. And they were told that there was a new experimental treatment out. And basically, my auntie was too ill to make the decision, so they asked my cousin. And she said, "Yes, yeah, go ahead with it. Please try it." A few months after that, my auntie died. My cousin said at the end, she said, "I wish we hadn't have bothered." All it did was give her a few more months of pain. So there are times when we stop treatment because it just isn't worth it. But that's withdrawing treatment, and that is totally different to withholding food and water. We've got a few young children here. How many can feed themselves? How many, if they were put in a house, could look after themselves? I don't know. Probably Mackenzie and Jensen couldn't. Grace might be able to help. But the point I'm making is this. Simply because somebody is unable to feed themselves doesn't mean to say we should stop feeding them. There's a difference between withdrawing food and drink and withdrawing treatment that is no longer working or is not going to be profitable. And we have to keep a very clear eye on the difference. Doctors in the United States and Netherlands have found that though the euthanasia was originally intended for exceptional cases, it has become an accepted way of dealing with serious or terminal illness. The original guidelines that patients with a terminal illness make a voluntary persistent request that their lives be ended have been expanded to include chronic ailments and psychological distress. They found that 60% of Dutch physicians do not report cases of assisted suicide, even though it's required by law, and about 25% of the physicians admit to ending patients' lives without their consent. Without their consent. The doctors have made a judgment, it's not worth it. Again, in the Netherlands, physicians have performed involuntary euthanasia because they thought the family had suffered too much. Okay, so we've expanded it beyond the actual patient. Their family's suffering too much. We'll just put them to death. Sort it out. An American surgeon, Robin Bernhoff, relates an incident in which a Dutch doctor euthanized a 26-year-old ballerina with arthritis in her toes. Since she could no longer pursue her career as a dancer, she was depressed and requested to be put to death. The doctor complied with the request and merely noted that one doesn't enjoy such things, but it was her choice. So you see, we have made an awful long way down the road of the slippery slope. Moving from the sanctity of human life into quality of life is a very dangerous place to go. The disabled, the retarded, the infirm are seen as having a special place in God's world, but medical personnel can judge that such a person's situation, their fitness for life, is not really worth it. Their quality of life is low. Quality of life judgments are always subjective, whoever makes them, and cannot be a basis for killing someone. It's been said that if a life is judged not worthy to be lived any longer, people feel obliged to end that life. Ultimately, it's God who puts a value on human life. He's the one who comes looking for us and wants us to be with him forever. There's more to life than what we have now, but what we have now is precious and God-given. We need to guard it for ourselves and others. Amen.